This is SASTR's Founders Favorite Series, where you can hear some of the best from SASTR speakers. This is where the cloud meets. Leading the way in time clock technology, On the Clock provides a seamless solution for businesses to track hours worked and connect with payroll providers, including QuickBooks, Gusto, Thomson Reuters, and more. Visit ontheclock.com and start your 30-day free trial today. FinTech is powering the next stage of growth in SaaS, and Stripe is helping companies like Shopify, HubSpot, and Substack transform their business with embedded payments and financial services. Visit Stripe.com to learn how you can build a powerful payment business. Invoca Conversation Intelligence unlocks the revenue-driving data that's hiding in every conversation you have during the buyer's journey. Leading brands like Dish Network, VITAS Healthcare, and 1-800-GOT-JUNK use Invoca to improve conversion rates, build exceptional customer experiences, and power accelerated revenue growth. Learn more at Invoca.com. Up today, Founder Confidential, the highs and lows of fundraising from founders that have raised $1 billion, featuring Shishir Mehrotra, CEO and co-founder at Coda, Edith Harbaugh, CEO and co-founder at LaunchDarkly, David Barrett, founder and CEO, Expensify, Jason Lemkin, CEO and founder at SASTR, and moderated by Lloyd Lobo, co-founder and president at Boast.ai.
So our panelists here have raised nearly $1 billion in funding, and that's not easy to do. That's really hard. But, you know, maybe considering the market today, that is not so hard. So let's dive right into it. The market is bonkers. Valuations are super high. I think Edith was the most recent to raise your round of funding. How should founders think about fundraising and valuations, particularly in this market?
Yeah, so we announced our Series D of $200 million at a $3 billion valuation, which is pretty fun to say, by the way.
Yeah. Is it fun?
Yeah. All right. I mean, it's. But behind that is like 7 years of grinding and the team working incredibly hard and us getting 2,000 customers and being recognized as the category leader. So like our first round of funding, I remember a co-founder and me celebrating about a 15K check from an angel. We were ground out. Our first round was like a 200K friends and family round, and that was excruciating.
Definitely. And then in terms of valuations right now, are they, what is it, 5x 2 years ago? Is it 10x? Like, how should founders think about, do they even command the valuation? Like, how did you go about it?
You know, the thing about evaluation is that you have to grow into it. I mean, David, I think, is actually a counterexample because we were talking backstage, like he's about to IPO. It's no secret.
But I was talking about.
Yeah. But you've raised very little money and been very efficient. So I kind of don't want people to just say like valuation when your private company amount raised is the measure of success. It's really about actually producing value.
Definitely. What's your viewpoint on that, Shishir?
I mean, I think the valuations have gone up because everybody's realized the markets are a lot bigger than they thought. And so it all sort of trickles down as you see these companies get much, much larger than people expected. So I think it's surprising to people that don't see the way technology is taking over industry after industry after industry.
Definitely. Yeah. David, how about you? What do you think about it?
I just think it's all bullshit. Like, I think the reason the valuations are high is because there's a shit ton of money in the markets and it has no place to go. Like, we just printed, $3.5 trillion of stimulus money out of nowhere, and it went to a whole bunch of people that have no place to spend it, so it just goes into the banks. The banks they're just flush with cash. They give it a tiny fraction at the VCs, and like, I don't give a shit where it goes to. It does not matter. There's a finite number of investments. They just get super competitive. The money has to go somewhere. No one cares about any of this. Like, none of it makes any sense. And so I think that the idea, like, I think there's a part of like, oh, the markets are bigger than we realize. The world didn't change. It's like, it's the same fucking size. And so I think like, maybe that's part of it. I actually don't think that's most of it. I think that most of it is none of this makes any sense. And so as a result, there's just a bunch of money going around and it's just all chaos.
Can I briefly disagree?
Please.
I do think the market has gotten bigger for SaaS. Like, I've been going to Saster back when we, I don't know, were stuffed up on Knob Hill. And my joke to Jason is you get a bigger venue and it fills again. But SaaS is not this new hot thing anymore. It's now an established category where, sure, you have people who are doing it, and the universe is much bigger in terms of, like, this is a way that you could build your business instead of it being seen as like a niche weird thing of will it last.
Yeah, but it's not like the market itself has changed. It's become, or rather, it hasn't grown that much. There's hundreds of millions of businesses in the world, and virtually none of them use any of our software. It's like, on a grand scheme of things, the entire sum of like SaaS is still like a rounding error of actually the global opportunity. But it's not that the opportunity hasn't been there all along. I think that we're just finally finding models that can acquire more of it. But I don't think the market's changed. More of the models have changed, perhaps. But even that, I still don't even think that's true. Because most of the companies rated in these shit tons of money, they're not using like novel customer acquisition techniques that couldn't have worked 20 years ago. They're just willing to lose more money on it. And then the VCs are willing to allow them to lose more money on it.
I will, again, respectfully disagree. You know, when we started 7 years ago, it was a slog to sell SaaS.
Yeah.
Like, we had our initial customers would always say, do you have an on-prem version? And we would say, no, we believe in SaaS. And they'd say, like, okay. And then they'd come back a year later and say, hey, we've actually moved out of our own data centers. We are ready to buy SaaS. So it has been this extreme uplift for us in terms of we're not arguing about cloud anymore.
But yeah, there's obviously truth to both sides of this. I mean, I think the markets are clearly bigger, and there is a lot of money going around, and they converge. I think the money also has other places to go other than SaaS. It doesn't have to come to us.
Sure.
And it's choosing to come here because I do think the markets are proving to be more open to these companies taking over business processes that they didn't used to be allowed to.
But I think what's interesting is David and I, we're all actually somewhat old timers of SaaS in different generations. We've been through like the three generations of post Salesforce SaaS. It's called Salesforce 1. You and I started Salesforce 2. Mm-hmm. Edith was maybe 2.5. And then Coda now is maybe 2.7 or third generation. But you've been doing this for a decade and a half.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, first of all, it was interesting when I did a podcast with Rene Lassert from Build.com, and his point was, there's still 6 million buyers of Build.com today, and there were when we started. So the TAM, in a sense, is the same.
Yeah.
But let me tell you the jaw-dropping statistic for us old-timers. In the BVP Cloud 100, which I think maybe LaunchDarkly was in, 25% of them were growing more than 100% at 100 million ARR. That is the difference in the cloud. The top quartile, not the top one or two, the top quartile is growing triple digits at 100 million. And when you think about compounding, assuming those have NRRs approach or north of 100, that means they're all going to hit a billion in revenue. So that is now, as silly as it sounds, that's commonplace, right? So what are the odds that any of us will do it? Well, you know, and Coda is interesting. The bet is that it's high, right? Coda has the team and the technology, and you've taken advantage of the market to raise at attractive valuations, but it's the same bet for, when I tell old timers that number, like their jaws drop a little. What?
So, but I think
the top quartile grows triple digits at 100 million. Because going triple digits at 10 million a generation ago was like, that was the magic number. Could you actually sustain 100% growth at 10 million five or 8 years ago was, you're fucking going to be a unicorn, right?
So, but that's interesting. So the TAM hasn't changed. The business model also hasn't changed. But the awareness that it could scale has changed, perhaps. And so people are willing to like project forward further now than they were before, which could explain the higher valuations as well.
It's made it easier to buy. So I wanted to get into the process, right? Like, you raised a $200 million round. Everyone here, or how many people have raised a round of funding? And how many people are looking to raise their next round? Okay, a whole bunch.
Yeah.
What is the process you guys followed? Maybe starting with David, because you raised $20 million. What was the process?
To Jason's point, like, the world's changed so much. And like, I don't know anything about this world anymore.
It really has changed. We'll get you up to speed.
Yeah.
Did you have a funnel?
It's better. Isn't it better? It's better,
I
mean, right?
I wonder.
I think the early rounds are entirely different than the later rounds. So,
but let's say an A or a B, right? Like Edith raised a D, but I don't know if it's that much dissimilar than a C or a B.
For the early rounds, the process is weird. I mean, you're meeting people, everybody is not quite sure what the business is. There's no metrics to look at. It's how well you tell your story. So on later rounds, it's a little bit more standard. These are the set of people you can talk to. These set of people are too early. These set are too late. They require this type of model of doing it. I mean, the biggest thing I tell people is compress the process. You can, you know, I think one thing we can all agree on, you should spend most of your time not fundraising. Mm-hmm. And so do whatever you can to take that process. And when you start it, finish it as fast as possible. Turns out that's actually very helpful for the process because there is an incredible amount of FOMO in these processes. And so make sure, I had one founder that he's raised money for 5 different companies, and I guess he's a serial entrepreneur. And his rule of thumb is no process over a week. So he'll start on Mondays, tell everybody, here's what I'm raising. I'm taking the best offer at the end of the week. And if I don't have a great offer, then it is what it is. But I'm not letting it expand out. I think compressing the process is very important that way. But it's very different, early and late.
Again, it's been a while for me. But early, you're just trying to scrap money together.
Yeah.
Like, I literally had a spreadsheet of everybody I knew that had money. Like, I'd been early at TripIt, I'd been at Vignette, I'd been at Concur, and I was like, do they have money? Can I ask them for something? And I just worked my way through the list and scrapped together the money. But late stage, it is much more about running it more like an enterprise sales process because your own time is valuable.
Yeah. 4 to 6 week sales cycle, bring people along at the same time. And it's also a very stressful process, right? When you got a lot of VCs in the mix, everyone wants you to meet somebody that, let me show you what I can do for you. Let me introduce you to this partner, that partner, everyone else. It's a huge time suck. So we actually, and I can speak about this, we were pulled into the Series B preemptively with 21 VCs, and I was having a kid, and we had all these new execs that just been for 2 months. And we ran this, I mean, we got pulled into the process, but the following Friday when everyone wanted to dive in the data room, like 21 people, I punted the raise. We just got together with the board and said, the timing is not right. The execs have not been at bats for even 2 quarters. How do we know even this model they're putting together is going to even play out? So we just punted it, and we said, let's talk in Q1. But that created a whole bunch of FOMO, them reaching out to a board, saying, do they want in secondary? Make sure, like, can we preempt? All of this stuff, right? It's just, as a founder, you want to run your company, and you should spend all your time running the company, so compress the process. I completely
agree. Yeah, I think those early days, it's like, yeah, I think there's so much hustle. So I'd say some specific advice would be, one, make your slide deck full of pictures, but no numbers. And two, when you reach out to a VC, they say, like, I'm not sure if I'm going to raise, but I'm thinking about it, and I really like you, so I'd love your advice. Because it's kind of like, if you want money, ask for advice. Because if you ask for money, you're just going to get advice.
That was in a song by Pitbull as well.
I'd say that the converse, though, is if it's an angel, just ask for the money. Because otherwise, they don't know. Like, that was...
No. Everyone likes to feel like that they're super smart. You're like, you're so smart. I love your advice. I read your shit. I'm thinking about raising. What do you think? And of course, they're venture capitalists. Their answer is always going to be yes. And so never mail your deck ahead of time, because then they'll make their decision before they see you. Show up, gesticulate, speak very loudly, swear some a little bit, you know, be edgy, and then say, like, hey, it's really great, and just say whatever number they want to hear, because it doesn't matter anyway. Oh, and then, but even then, before that, I would probably do a Kickstarter, free money, something like that, as much as I can get. I do an ICO. Is that a thing anymore? I'd try it anyway, because why not?
David, I don't know if you're just trolling us at this point or not.
No. David. There's all sorts of great options out there. Like, as the early days, you got to fucking hustle. And so, yeah, I would do all of these things. I would scrape together all of this, and I would avoid the VCs as long as possible, because they're the devil. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes you need to do a deal with the devil, but you're probably going to get fucked in the process. And that's okay. Maybe that's just acceptable for the path that you're going to take.
So Dave and I agree on one thing, don't have a deck.
Okay. Don't what? Send the deck?
Don't have a deck.
Yeah. Out of all that, that was one piece. Actually, I'll go one step further. The deck is actually, I agree, tell your story whichever you can. I like to use whatever I presented to the board last as my starting point.
Oh, that's cool.
But the one thing I would encourage writing is write the investment memo that you think they should write to their partners. One of the things I think founders often miss is you're pitching a person who's going to become your advocate. Right? And think about it in enterprise sales terms, this is your sponsor. That person cannot say yes. That person can only say no. So help that person turn around to their partners
that's
and pitch your story on your behalf.
That's
the one thing I would encourage writing.
Or even at the end of your meeting with them, say, well, how would you pitch my company?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can see if you've just like...
Oh, that's what I was like, if you're asking for advice, then if they ever catch you in something, you say like, man, thank you so much for finding that. How would you recommend I answer that question that you just caught me on? Mm-hmm. Because it puts them into a collaborative mindset rather than an antagonistic one.
Can I just add one like quantitative piece on this? I know we're out of time. So you guys know Mark Roberge. He spoke on Tuesday. He was CRO HubSpot. Mm-hmm. So he's at Harvard Business School now, and he started investing a couple years ago. I think he raised an $8 million initial fund for operators and revenue, and he just raised 80. And I was talking with him in the green room, and I'm like, how's the investing going? And he's like, you gave me some great advice. He's like, yeah, when we started, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, we'd get 3 to 4 interesting inbounds a week. He said, now we get 100. Not random, not randos, not weird in-mails, 100 good companies. So there's all this advice on the internet, but remember, you have to actually break out so much more than you used to. This coffee advice, I will tell you, during our digital events, I did one called, it was called Sastra Money, and I asked Keith Raboy, David Sachs, Eileen Lee, Christoph Jantz, and Satya Patel from Homebrew, all sitting on massive gains. Every single one of them said they read every single cold email they get, and every single one of them invests in 1 week. So that's the way the world changed. Now that sounds interesting, but even if Mark, who I love, but is new to venture, gets 100, there are so many SaaS companies today. If he gets 100, how are you gonna break through that 100? Do you want coffee? Do you wanna not send the deck? Do you wanna just talk about your theory of collaboration software or feature flags? I don't think any of that works anymore when Mark's getting, and he's got a brand, don't get me wrong, he's got Magnet, but 100 a week. And then he flies out to Sastr, he's another 100 behind because it came out from Boston. So just think about how the odds have changed and don't get all the headline things to confuse because statistically, in a way, odds might be harder, right? But once you break through, it's easier, right? LaunchDarkly, 200K from Concur people, but now 200 million in a week, right? I mean, it's just such, but you had to break through to the obvious category, right? So just don't forget those 100 a week.
But
VC can process 100, even with the team, it's too many, isn't it?
Yeah.
No matter what anybody says.
That's interesting.
You could do like 3, right? If you really want to have a conversation as CEOs, how many deep conversations can you have a week? A couple, right? A couple. So just think about the odds.
But that's a good question to perhaps close out with, or maybe we'll do another one. What is the best way to build relationships with VCs and break out? You're getting 100 in your inbox. Jason's a proponent of cold emails. Some VCs are not. But like, what is the best way to build relationships? Well, what is the best way to get that coffee meeting when Mark Roberge's or Jason Lemkin's inbox is with thousands of emails?
I think you would deliver results first, and then they wait for them to come to you. Focus all your time on building a product that customers care about, and then the VCs will care about you. And doing the reverse, I think, is very, very hard.
This is surprising, but I actually agree with David again.
Great.
You know, you know, focus on your business. You know, focus on your business. Build up your customer base. Your customers will start talking. They are the ones who will tell the VC what they're using in-house or what the new tools are, and that will build your brand for you. To build the actual relationship, I do really like, it sounds stereotypical, but like a coffee or a lunch and just slotting that into your schedule every month. So that way you can meet 12 different VCs in a year. And so that when it is time to actually run a fundraising process, you're not starting from a cold start of like,
that's clever.
Do I even like this person at all? Do they like me? Do they get me?
I think the obviously agreed on the focus on your business first. I'd give two suggestions. One is when you're pitching, take advice from people one stage, investors that are one stage forward or back from wherever you're pitching. Huh. Just go, you know, you're pitching people for a normal B, go talk to a few people that would normally be C and D raisers, show them this is the investment memo I'm pre-writing, what do you think? And they'll know they're not in the market for it and they'll give you real advice. And they all know they're kind of, I want to be involved in this raise, I'm getting an early peek, it's something that might come later. You can do that early too, is like go have the seed investor guide you on your A. That's one thing. The other thing is just find, I mean, they're all people. Just find a way to connect with them that doesn't have anything to do with raising money. And candidates ask me that question all the time. How do I get a job at Google? I said, number one thing, don't show up in the recruiting folder. Show up in some other folder of why you're reaching out. And everybody has different ways of doing it. You know, for me, I have a lot of other, because of the way Coda works and the way we like to promote ourselves, I'll generally reach out to people about how they run their companies, how their other companies run. That turns out to be a very good way for me to stay connected with people. Everybody has their own way of doing it. Some people do it with, you know, with sports or events or whatever. But I think just don't show up in their fundraising folder until you actually want to be in their fundraising folder.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to take one last question. It's going to be fun. But for you, if you got three intros, like if Mark Roberge introduces you to somebody and maybe two other VCs you really respect saying, hey, you got to talk to this portfolio company, you're going to take that intro, right? Or no?
I just want to say two things, and maybe let's wrap up, because this panel's going to go forever. One is, don't fall into the trap that you have to have a warm intro to meet an investor. Cold emails work. I did this thing online. I asked five of the top investors, including Eileen, Keith, they all read the cold. Now, no one at the Series C level reads the cold email, okay? Because they all assume, they all assume that companies at this stage know everybody. It don't work. But don't assume you have to. It sucks if you're not privileged. It sucks if you didn't come out of Google or Y Combinator. It does suck, but you can break through it. This is our job as founders. So don't feel like cold emails don't work. They do work. And the one thing I just want to, all the advice you hear, it's back and forth. Edith said something which distills all of it. Like, fundraising is sales, and fundraising has pre-brand sales and post-brand sales, just like SaaS does. And once you have a brand, it's all different. They will come to you. It doesn't mean you'll close all the deals, but the leads start coming in venture. But don't confuse the two stages. Until you have a brand, right, until you're maybe even at 10 million ARR, it's sales, hustle. And if you think hiding stuff is good in sales, fucking go hide the deck, okay? If you think coffee enterprise sales works for you, go do it. But remember, it's sales. And I say in sales, put your best foot forward, do it the way you know how to do, and it's selling stock. And founders get really, really good at it. You're hearing almost too good of advice, because by the time you've sold stock five times, you've met with 500 investors, and founders get fucking good at this, right? But it's sales. And if you're not good at it, be thoughtful and take the risk to do whatever it takes to close the deal.
That's great advice.
Leading the way in time clock technology, On the Clock provides a seamless solution for businesses to track hours worked and connect with payroll providers, including QuickBooks, Gusto, Thomson Reuters, and more. Visit ontheclock.com and start your 30-day free trial today. FinTech is powering the next stage of growth in SaaS, and Stripe is helping companies like Shopify, HubSpot, and Substack transform their business with embedded payments and financial services. Visit Stripe.com to learn how you can build a powerful payment business. Invoca is the conversation intelligence platform for leading business-to-consumer revenue teams. From marketing to e-commerce to the contact center, Invoca's AI-powered conversation intelligence drives performance by unlocking the goldmine of data from customer conversations. Learn how you can improve the buying experience and accelerate revenue with conversation intelligence at Invoca.com.